Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Having crafted a unique biography of one of the world's great oceans in his best-selling Atlantic, Simon Winchester now looks westward to an even larger body of water. Pacific, silicon chips and surfboards, coral reefs and atom bombs, brutal dictators, fading empires, and the coming collision of the world's superpowers is a rich and sprawling account of what Simon Winchester calls the inland sea of the world's tomorrow. Simon Winchester is the acclaimed author of many books, including The Professor and the Madman, Atlantic, The Man Who Loved China, A Crack in the Edge of the World, and Krakatoa. It is a great pleasure to welcome Simon Winchester to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, sir.
Joe, it's the same for me. Thank you.
It seems that this was inevitable, that if you write about the Atlantic, you will write about the Pacific.
But I'm not going to write about the Indian Ocean, so fear not. But no, it seemed to have a logic to it because the Atlantic, and then I did a book about the United States, and it seemed sensible to continue this westward move and have a look at the Pacific. And I'd lived on beside the Pacific for many years when I lived in Hong Kong in the 80s and 90s, and it would be conceited to say I know it, but I've sort of traipsed around it quite a bit. And so really for this, I, once having decided to do it, I went off to Hawaii during the brutal winter, not last winter, but the one before, which was pretty brutal too, and annoyed all of my friends in Sandersfield by when they were huddled in the cold, basking in Honolulu. But I was in an office there working and ventured out to lots of the islands that I hadn't seen during the 13 years I lived in Hong Kong. So I've now tramped around quite a lot of the Pacific, and it was an enormously stimulating book to write.
So let me ask one of the obvious questions, which is how much of the story of the Atlantic and the story of the Pacific is similar? Is ground that has been tread? And then how do you rectify that in looking at all of the differences?
Well, they're very different oceans in all sorts of ways. And so I would say there's very little overlap. I mean, they're both made of water and they've both got fish and so forth.
Right.
But the Atlantic I think of as, I'm very much, if you like, today's ocean. After all, it was the crossing of it which created the New World and which built America and Canada and much of South America. I think of it as almost as a grey, industrial, salty ocean. I mean, I know that sounds in a way ludicrous, but the Pacific, the image we have of it, is of a very different place. Blue and relatively Pacific, at least that's what Magellan saw when he sailed into it in 1529. But the crucially important thing that makes it signally different from the Atlantic is that this ocean, the Pacific, and this, it's vast. I mean, when you consider it's 10,600 miles from Panama to Palawan, I mean, in the Philippines, it's a very four times the width of the United States, that it's really the ocean where the two great civilizations of the world finally meet. Because if we look back all those hundreds of thousands of years to when humankind originated in Ethiopia, and one big group headed off northeastwards and went to, you know, the Fertile Crescent and Mesopotamia and the Indus Valley and then China. And the other group, I mean, this is very crudely, of course, went up through the Balkans and into Europe and then crossed the Atlantic into the Americas and then eventually, under the pressures of the Manifest Destiny, crossed westward until they were teetering on the brink of the Pacific. And then in the 16th century, crossed the Pacific. And at long last, these two civilizations, the ones that had been in China, as it were, China, Japan, Korea, Asia generally, finally met those who had come all the other way around the world. And so that, initially, the tone was hostile, because what did we Westerners do? We colonized, we subdued, subjugated these people, spoiled their ocean in all sorts of ways, were disdainful and disrespectful of them. And then in recent years, since the sort of 1940s and 50s, we've drawn back. The empire has left the Pacific, and the Pacific is at long last beginning to stand on its own two feet. And I think that's the crucial difference, that the Atlantic never quite experienced this, but because of the collision, initially hostile, but perhaps in the future less so, of the two of the world's two basic civilizations, that the theater on which this is happening, the Pacific Ocean, is very, very different from anywhere else.
You just mentioned the future, and you make the point in the book that you feel the Pacific is the ocean of the future.
Very much so, because now facing off against each other are, what are undeniably the two great remaining superpowers of the world. I mean, the United States on the eastern side and China, like it or not, this is a gigantic and increasingly wealthy and powerful country. And as I say, both of these two countries distill in their essence the two early civilizations of the planet. So how do they treat with one another? Well, at the moment, things are looking a little tense, it has to be said. You know, there's suspicion of China. There's been for many years a sort of racist view of the Chinese were excluded, as of course were the Japanese and Koreans for a long time, from coming easily to the United States. That's no longer true, of course. But the forces that the Chinese are beginning to muster in, let's say, their naval forces are beginning, in Washington's view, to look rather threatening because they're very big. And my view is that at long last, the Chinese are saying, look, for the last 60 years, the United States has regarded the Pacific as a gigantic American lake. And that's fine. And the Americans will say, yes, it is an American lake. And because it's been an American lake, because we've brought an immense amount of stability to the Pacific, so the great cities of the Western Pacific, particularly, you know, Seoul and Shanghai and Manila and so forth, have become modern and prosperous. Now the Chinese are saying, well, fine, we're just as big and powerful as you are. We want parity. We want to be able to run our ships all over the Pacific, just as you have. It's not an American lake, it's an everyone's lake, and we want parity. And the Americans are getting concerned about that, and hence there's tension in the air, or tension in the sea.
Simon Winchester's new book is Pacific. It is published by Harper. When it comes to the idea of writing a book about a subject as large as the Pacific, the way you go about this, similar to Atlantic, but the way you go about this is writing and selecting 10 moments. And that helps you give us a structure of and an idea of this behemoth.
I'm so glad you brought it up, because that to me is the key to writing about big topics like this, which the last three books have been pretty big, rather daunting topics. I've always thought that, I mean, there are three key elements in writing a book like this. The first, the most important thing, is the idea. You've got to have a decent idea. So I'm hoping that the idea of the Pacific is regarded as a good one. I cross my fingers that people think so. You'd think idly the second important thing is fine writing. Well, it is lovely if you can achieve fine writing, and one, of course, tries very hard to do so. But it's not, in my view, the second most important thing, because as you just said, the second most important thing really is the structure. You've got to come up with a sensible and coherent structure. You can write lyrically about a good idea, but if the structure's all wrong, people will just go to sleep. So what kind of a structure do you impose on a subject as gigantic as the Pacific? Well, with the Atlantic, I structured it according to the Seven Ages of Man from Shakespeare's As You Like It, and that seemed to work quite well.
Right.
The United States book, I structured that according to the five basic elements of Chinese philosophy: wood, earth, water, fire, and metal. Mercifully, that seemed to work. But with this, it was much more daunting, simply because it's so big, has so many billions of people, so many ethnicities, so many different kinds of geography, different kinds of problems. And in the end, what I decided to do was I decided to make a start point 1950, January the 1st, 1950, and an end point in May 2014, which was sort of when I was writing the book, but there is actually a specific reason too. And within those 64 years, make a list of hundreds of things that happened during those 64 years, sort of culling newspaper articles and magazines and scientific journals and so forth, and then to distill those down to 10, to try and select the 10 events and put them in chronological order, but that when you read them all, you come, I hope, and this is, you know, the book lives or dies according to whether my selection is right or wrong, which will give you a portrait of the Pacific today and as I hope, I think it will develop in the future. So selecting those 10 was very difficult. And, you know, if there were 300 things that I initially selected, that means 290 small tragedies were on the cutting room floor, things I decided not to incorporate. But in the end, I looked at the development of thermonuclear weapons. I looked at the invention of the transistor radio. I looked at, and you may think this is trivial, but the launch of the film Gidget in 1959, yes, which transformed the whole attitude towards surfing.
I found that fascinating.
Did you really?
Yes.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, I should say, incidentally, that Gidget, since I wrote the book, wrote to me the other day, and she's now, it's a true story, Gidget. It's about Kathy Kona. Well, she's now Kathy Zimmerman, and she's 72 years old, and she surfs every day, and she lives in Malibu. And she's read the book and likes it, and we're having lunch in California in early December.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of those things, though. You say trivial, but that is, like most large subjects, there are the very important things, and then there are the culturally important things.
I'm so glad you noticed that. I mean, there are the, quote, very important things, like the coming collision between China and the United States.
Right.
But how nice to sort of spend, I don't know, 50 pages ruminating on the origins of surfing, which are fascinating and involve people like Jack London, who was the first Westerner really to encounter surfing in 1907 and wrote this lyrical essay about it for, of all publications, The Woman's Home Companion. And this prompted people suddenly to buy or create surfboards and start surfing Redondo Beach and Huntington Beach and Bondi in Australia. But then Gidget in 1959 made suddenly everyone realize, well, if a 15-year-old girl can stand up on the waves and do this, then we can do it too. And now it's a $13 billion a year industry all over the world. It's a very sort of democratic sport because it's not expensive. And it's also infected management techniques, which I think was extraordinary. I mean, this all started with the Patagonia company. Yvon Chouinard, the man that founded Patagonia, was a very keen surfer. And he thought, okay, I'm going to put my first factories making the clothing and stuff that he makes and put it on the Pacific Coast Highway in view of a surfing beach and say to my employees, if the surf's up, go and surf. Because I know when it's over, the waves have quieted down again, you'll come back to my factory and you'll work hard and you'll think I'm a good boss. And so the whole concept of flex time was eventually born as a product out of surfing. And so when people like Facebook and Google and so forth have FaceTime instead of your normal 9-to-5 regime, that all started thanks to Gidget.
Transistor radio.
Indeed. I mean, that's, look at us here. I mean, I dare say most of our listeners today are listening on small devices in their cars or in their houses, but in 1955, before the transistor radio first hit the streets, the radio was a piece of furniture. I mean, it was covered with walnut veneer, and you put the aspidistra on top of it, and you turned it on, and it warmed up, and you tuned it in, and it crackled and hissed. Then suddenly, August the 8th, 1955, in a store, first of all, in Edmonton, Alberta, Winnipeg and Vancouver, this little tiny thing which would fit into your shirt pocket appeared in the stores for $35 or so. This was called the TR-55. It was the first ever transistor radio. It was invented in Japan, and on the top of the dial it said TOTSCO, which is Tokyo Telecommunications Company, but underneath, in tiny little letters, was the word Sony. And it was the first invention by the Sony Corporation in Japan, and specifically of this remarkable and forgotten man called Masaru Ibuka, who was the great inventor, the genius behind Sony. And he invented the transistor radio. He invented the Walkman, if you remember that. He invented the Trinitron television. He invented the Betamax. I mean, he was an absolute electronic genius. And this transformation of radio sets no longer being furniture, but something we could carry with us to the beach, to the pool, in our car, into bed, thereby personalizing the listening experience, led to a whole concatenation of circumstances which ultimately made the trade pattern across the Pacific gigantically from west to east, suddenly container ships, and the container had been invented almost at exactly the same time as the transistor radio, were leaving ports like Yokohama and going to Vancouver or San Francisco or Long Beach, and then ultimately ports in Korea would take Samsung devices, and then ports in China, which are now the biggest in the world, of course, started sending their trade goods, mostly electronics and optics, to the United States and Canada and the Americas generally. So this whole, every time you see a huge evergreen container ship going in under the Golden Gate Bridge into San Francisco Bay, into the container ports in Oakland, that all began effectively with the appearance in a store in Edmonton, Alberta, on the 8th of August, 1955, of this tiny little radio set.
Given that you could have gone back centuries, you begin the story in 1950 with President Truman's decision to build and test the hydrogen bomb. Why is that a good starting point?
Well, it's for an odd reason, but oddly enough connected with the bombs. It's to do with the dating systems that we use today. I mean, we still, many of us cling to BC and AD. This is AD 2015, and the Romans invaded Britain, if I remember from school, 55 BC. Tragic day for the Brits, of course. But that requires us to be Christians before Christ and Anno Domini, and of course we're not. And a lot of people find that either irrelevant or offensive, and so this other convention was adopted about 30 years ago, BCE, which is either for Christians before Christian era or for the more secularly minded before Common Era. But that's not good enough for the scientists. And they came up with another convention also about 20 or 30 years ago called BP. You talk about the Wisconsin Ice Age as having occurred 10,000 years BP. And BP means before present. But that prompts the question, well, when is present? Well, present has been decided by a group of radio chemists at the Queen's University, Belfast, to be the 1st of January 1950 for a very simple reason, that before 1950, carbon-14 dating, that's the ratio between carbon-12 and carbon-14, was, everyone knew what it was, and so you could work out, because of the half-life of carbon-14, when something died. However, after 1950, because of nuclear testing, the amount of additional carbon-14 thrown up into the atmosphere by humankind distorted all this, and so carbon-14 dating became terribly inaccurate. And so it's been decreed that before 1950, the world was, as it were, pure. And after 1950, the world was impure. And the impurities, and this is from my point of view a good thing, were thrown up in the Pacific Ocean. So this seemed a marvelous and logical and rather beautiful moment at which to begin the story of the ocean.
Simon Winchester is our guest on this week's book show. The new book is Pacific. It is published by Harper. You touched on this earlier, and I just want to delve deeper into it, looking at what is affecting the Pacific Ocean now. We're talking about the exploitation of this resource, of water. We're certainly talking about climate change and global warming, as well as pollution. And I'm interested as to what that ultimately means, because you have talked a moment ago about the political forces and what that means. But we had Ted Koppel on this program a few weeks ago talking about a possible cyber attack. And I asked the question, was, well, how screwed are we? and I guess I asked the same question to you, which is, knowing what California is going through, knowing what the ocean is going through, yeah, how screwed are we?
Well, I think we are screwed, but I don't think the planet is screwed. And the planet is not screwed because of the Pacific, oddly enough.
By the way, in that accent, that sounds so much nicer than when I said it. Just pointing it out.
Well, thank you so much. In this book, I mean, so complex. There's, you know, things we know about the Pacific garbage gyre, this huge concentration of garbage between Hawaii and Vancouver. The rising sea levels, that's happening. Islands are being flooded. Kiribati, the only place in the world, incidentally, which spans, goes both across the Dateline and the equator, meaning that it's a country in which is both yesterday and today and summer and winter all at the same time, that's going to be flooded because the rising sea levels, the sea is becoming warmer, the sea is becoming more acid. Because of that, the coral reefs are bleaching, fish are dying, birds are becoming extinct. So there is all sorts of horrible mayhem going on. But at the same time, I'm a great believer in this sort of near mystical thing called the Gaia theory, where the world itself, the planet, is a self-correcting mechanism. And things are happening within the Pacific, most notably a creature which also, of course, exists in the Atlantic, which we didn't know existed until 1989, called Prochlorococcus. One in five of the breaths that you and I are exchanging in the studio today is generated by this creature which lives in the sea, tiny little single-celled algae, which we didn't know existed until we found it in 1989, and which loves warm water. The warmer the water gets, the more of these creatures there are, which means they absorb more carbon dioxide and generate more oxygen. So humankind is going to hell in a handbasket. There's no doubt about it. Either we'll obliterate ourselves with nuclear destruction, or we'll cause environmental damage that will extinguish us. We'll drown us, or the weather will get so bad because these storms are that are increasingly frequent, particularly in the Pacific, are definitely linked to global warming. But once we're out, once we're fossils, which we soon will be, and the definition of soon is, of course, it's very flexible. My old professor at Oxford thought we would not be here after 2200 AD. In other words, another 150 years right. tops. But once we're out of the way, then the planet will repair itself. It always has, and it probably always will. I mean, obviously, in hundreds of millions of years, that will not necessarily be the case. But in the relatively short geological time frame, the planet will be okay. And the Pacific, because it is so huge and acts as a huge heat sink, which the sun's rays will be absorbed by, is a principal component in that self-repair mechanism. We're done for, but the planet isn't.
So let me end on a hopefully more upbeat note, and that is the joy in reading your work, in my opinion, is your range of curiosity. It is fascinating to see that curiosity at work from beginning to end. And to think, as you say, to take a list of 300 and bring it down to 10 and with a scalpel excise all of the fat and bring that together, I assume fueled by that curiosity, seems like a monumental achievement.
Well, it's jolly nice of you to say that, but it's just enormous fun. I mean, I sit there in Sandersfield in my little barn and I think about these things and it gives me the greatest of pleasure. This book was huge fun to research, obviously. I mean, who would not wish to go to the Sea of Okhotsk and the Kuril Islands and New Zealand? That was all fine, but actually to sit down and make these decisions and write it, I have such fun writing these books.
And there is the writing, but then there is the thinking, and there is that curiosity, which I think would be equally fun.
It is, and I hope it never goes away. I mean, I know what I'm going to write next, and it's, oddly enough, going to bring me a lot to Albany, funnily enough, so I'll be seeing a lot more of you. But there's, yes, I am very, very curious, and but it's a very curious world.
The name of the new book is Pacific Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. Heck of a subtitle.
Not generated by me, really. It was, for me, and the Australian and the British editions of this book are much more elegant. Pacific, the Ocean of the Future. The Americans say, for Google searches, we've got to have all these sub words in the subtitle. I promise you, Joe, the next book, I know exactly what it's going to be called. It has a four-word subtitle, and that's it.
Well, we'll simply say Pacific, published by Harper, by Simon Winchester. It's always a delight to have you with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
She's got the smile and style that you can't resist. The way she moves just proves angels do exist. Wait till you see my Gidget. You want her for your Valentine. You're gonna say she's all that you adore, but stay away. A Gidget is spoken for. You're gonna find that